This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, April 12, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. As a suicide bomber kills 8 people inside the Iraqi parliament, the U.S. begins plans to extend troops' tours of duty by 3 months. 5 people are killed during a public demonstration protesting the Ugandan government's decision to destroy part of the country's largest rainforest. And Texas executes the 12th person so far this year, despite his defenders' claims that he was mentally retarded. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State John Negroponte arrived in Khartoum today to meet with Sudanese officials over the crisis in the country's western Darfur region. The visit comes as fighting has spilled over into neighboring Chad. China is also facing pressure over its close relationship with the Sudanese government. Elise Potaka has more.
Celebrities and politicians, including actress Mia Farrow and French presidential candidate François Bayrou, have said that China is effectively bankrolling the genocide in Sudan's Darfur region. China is the biggest buyer of Sudanese oil, and critics say this money is being used to fuel government-backed militias in Darfur. Last weekend, China's assistant foreign minister Jai Jun met with Sudan's president Omar Hassan Ahmed al-Bashir to talk about the humanitarian crisis. At a briefing, foreign ministry spokesperson Qin Gang said that China's position on the Darfur issue is clear and consistent, that it should be solved through political endeavor. They are now pushing for a United Nations peacekeeping force in the region. On Wednesday, the U.S. envoy to Sudan, Andrew Natsios, defended China's efforts and said that China's subtle diplomacy is complementary to U.S. efforts. But critics have responded by asking why China is still selling arms to Sudan. At another important round of talks, which ended last week, China agreed to even further strengthen its military ties with the Sudanese. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Elise Portaka in Beijing.
The U.S. Senate has once again passed a bill to allow federal dollars to fund embryonic stem cell research. The measure passed yesterday with bipartisan support. President Bush has vowed to veto the legislation. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said the Senate will vote again on the measure immediately after the veto, and he will work to pick up the 4 votes necessary to override the presidential veto. For the first time in its 40-year history, a member of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee's staff has been murdered. Doug Cunningham has the story.
The AFL-CIO's Farm Labor Organizing Committee, or FLOC, says the brutal beating death of Mexican organizer Santiago Rafael Cruz was an attack on the union, not a random murder. FLOC spokesman Michael Hale.
Santiago was found tied up and beaten to death, and nothing was stolen. This is not looking like it was a crime of theft or a random act of violence, but rather a targeted attack on FLOC.
Cruz was found beaten to death April 9th in the union's Monterrey, Mexico office. Since the Farm Labor Organizing Committee organized 5,000 H-2A visa program immigrant workers in North Carolina in 2004, Cruz had been helping the workers with contract grievances from FLOC's Mexican office. Hale says FLOC has often faced anti-union hostility both in North Carolina and in Mexico.
Everything from really disturbing phone calls to hostility from growers in the South to all kinds of racism in the United States South, and a lot of harassment in the Mexico office from labor contractors.
AFL-CIO President John Sweeney has called on the Mexican and U.S. governments to ensure that there is a thorough and professional investigation of the murder. For Free Speech Radio News, Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News.
Hundreds of activists and homeless people set up camp today in the south lawn of Los Angeles City Hall to protest the city's inaction on the issue of homelessness. Tanisizwe Shimarenga reports.
The Los Angeles Coalition to End Hunger and Homelessness organized today's action to send the message that jails cannot substitute a lack of effective housing policy in the city. Camilo Romero is an organizer with the coalition.
We're currently in the middle of a march through Skid Row, up to City Hall, the South Lawn, to hold Mayor Villaraigosa and others accountable. We've been here since 7 a.m. We'll be here till 4:30 p.m. Los Angeles is the capital of homelessness in the U.S., with over 90,000 homeless persons on any given night.
New York spends $212 per capita, or over $1.7 billion annually, on homeless services and housing, while Los Angeles spends $1 per capita on homelessness. Organizers stress that today is only one action in their campaign to make the local administration end homelessness in Los Angeles. This is Tandasizwe Shimaringa for Free Speech Radio News.
And finally, novelist Kurt Vonnegut died late last night from brain injuries resulting from a bad fall. Vonnegut is perhaps best known for Slaughterhouse-Five, a largely autobiographical tale of his experience as a prisoner of war during World War II. Vonnegut was one of only 7 U.S. prisoners to survive the massive firebombing of the German city of Dresden. Kurt Vonnegut died in New York City last night at the age of 84. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
A suicide bomber, believed to be a Sunni MP's bodyguard, blew himself up inside the Iraqi parliament in Baghdad's Green Zone today. 8 people died, including 3 politicians, and at least 30 people were injured when the attack took place in the cafeteria during lunchtime. This breach of Green Zone security comes as the United States announces troop tours of duty will be extended by 3 months. Response to the news is not one of surprise, rather something to be expected. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
The announcement by Defense Secretary Robert Gates that troop tours will be extended from 12 to 15 months came as no surprise to Mackenzie Eagland. She's senior policy analyst for national security at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C.
For every soldier that's currently serving in Iraq, it's a 1-in-3 rule. You have one that just got back from Iraq and one that's getting ready to go over there. And so if you add it up, you have the entire U.S. Army engaged in this effort right now. And yes, this announcement was unfortunately not a surprise.
If the 15-month troop deployment is new Pentagon policy, it's not new Pentagon practice. Since the president began to implement his troop surge, at least 2 brigades have had their tours extended beyond the 12 months. But Democrats in Congress are using this latest news to illustrate the president's mishandling of the war and as an opportunity to push for their supplemental that includes a timeline for withdrawal. Assistant Majority Leader Richard Durbin.
It will mean the longest tours since World War II. It will mean hardship, not only for the soldiers, but their families back home. It is undoubtedly going to have a negative impact on recruitment and retention. And quite honestly, some of these soldiers and Marines and others have been called time and again to serve.
Because of the extended tours, the Pentagon said they will ensure that service members receive a full year between deployment, a practice that has also been sidelined to accommodate combat needs. Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, opposed the president's troop surge, but has not supported an effort to end the war. But she says a troop extension is devoid of a plan.
It still does not chart a path out of Iraq. And I am concerned that the administration has yet to provide for a plan after the surge.
Nancy Lesson, head of the peace group Military Families Speak Out, says her members feel let down.
It was the news media, for the most part, and an email that we sent out to our 3,300 member families, that was their notification. The military did not notify families in many cases, nor did they notify the troops who are going to be involved in this, and that's just kind of a continuing disrespect.
Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union released a series of documents obtained from the Pentagon as a result of a Freedom of Information Act. These 500 files are the most extensive release of Pentagon records on civilian deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Pentagon keeps the records because their claims for compensation filed by Iraqi and Afghan families on the deaths of their loved ones by American troops. Nasrina Bargzi is with the National ACLU.
The U.S. government shields information about the human cost of war in various ways. So we're putting this out there for people to look at and to really just, understand what's going on. Civilians are being killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. And these files remind us that, war imposes very heavy burdens on innocent civilians, and we hope people will look at these documents.
The ACLU believes there are more records still under lock and key because of time gaps between the documents, and also because these claims equate to several million dollars of compensation compared to the $32 million the military says they have paid to Iraqi and Afghan families for the deaths of their loved ones. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
5 people were killed in violent clashes during a public demonstration to protest a decision by the Ugandan government to destroy part of the Mabita Forest Reserve, the country's largest rainforest, and give it to an Indian investor to use as a sugarcane plantation. Emmanuel Okello reports that the demonstration turned racially charged when angry protesters pounced on unsuspecting Asians who form a bigger share of the business community in Uganda's capital, Kampala.
A demonstration that started quietly escalated into a brutal mob scene when demonstrators, carrying placards and tree branches, attacked Indian nationals who own shops in the city and more than 50% of Uganda's processing industry. The demonstration by conservationists, politicians, and members of the public was against Shekhar Mehta, an Indian national who has established several businesses, including a leading sugar factory in the country. The protesters marched through the streets of Kampala while attacking passing Indian motorists. Some of their placards carried warnings to the Asians to remember the year 1972 when the then Ugandan president Idi Amin expelled all Asians from the country. The protesters smashed and burned several vehicles and invaded Asian-owned shops, forcing anti-riot police to fight bullets and tear gas.
Please, police, desist from coming to the scene of the rally. Don't provoke the people, but people, please don't throw stones.
The situation worsened when a passing Asian motorist knocked dead 2 children while trying to flee the rampaging protesters. The children were part of a brass band team marching in the procession. The male driver was trailed and lynched by the crowd. 2 other Asian men were beaten to death, while several others sustained injuries during the mobbing. Susan Nampija, a city member of parliament, says police should have made sure that all Asians remained indoors because it was possible that demonstrators would physically attack people during the demonstration.
If people have killed Indians, then it's the police that are to blame. The police should have known that this demonstration is against Mehta, an Indian, and definitely the Indian community would be targets. The police should have advised the Asian community not to come to the city center because Ugandans are angry. We are not going to allow any Indian to come and make us destitute in our own country.
Over 20 people have been arrested in connection with the demonstration, which had initially been sanctioned by the police on condition that it would be peaceful. One of the organizers of today's demonstration, Beatrice Anywa, the shadow minister for environment, regrets the deaths but adds that they are contented the demonstration has passed a strong message to the government.
For me, I'm happy that Ugandans have come up to resist the Mabira giveaway. Despite the fact that they have given us tear gas, we have resisted and marched on Kampala Road and reached here. The message is clear to the government that the Ugandans are not going to allow Mabira to be given to an investor. And is there already a warning to the investors, especially Mehta of Skol, to take note of today's event, that should he go ahead and connive with the government to take over Mabira, we shall ask people, as you have seen them today here, still to come and resist their taking over Mabira.
Today's incident comes after the government adamantly ignored a countrywide public uproar to save the Mabira Forest Reserve. Police say they are providing security to Asians living in the city and have also been helping some evacuate to the airport, some who wanted to leave the country today afternoon. There are unconfirmed reports that Mehta was among those who fled the country, fearing a deadly uprising. Attempts to get a comment from a member of the Asian community proved futile, as most of them were reported in hiding for fear of the attacks. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okela, reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
MSNBC has announced that they will no longer air Don Imus' show after several advertisers, including American Express and General Motors, pulled their commercials from the program. Imus referred to the players on the Rutgers women's basketball team as, quote, nappy-headed hoes, unquote, which led to a call for boycott from the African-American community. CBS Radio, meanwhile, has opted to suspend Imus's program for 2 weeks starting next Monday. Uprising Radio's Sonali Kohatkar spoke with journalist and activist Jill Nelson today about the Imus scandal.
I think his comment was first and foremost a sexist one. You know, in the African-American community, we, and in America, if we deal with race, we deal with race as a male issue. And so I think that the emphasis has been on race because the people who are speaking to this issue, by and large, in the mainstream, critically, are men. What I'm stunned by and what I blogged about, as you know, is the almost total absence of African-American women or women of color in this dialogue as commentators.
What about Don Imus's very, I think, weak justification that he tries to contextualize his comments by bringing hip-hop into the discussion and talking about how so many rappers use misogynist lyrics, and so if it's okay for them, why not for him?
It's comparing apples and asparagus. And, you know, for Don Imus to front that he's so hooked into and down with the African-American community and hip-hop, that he's just speaking as a homeboy, it's insulting to all of our intelligence. And it does nothing, in my mind, but further compound his insults.
I also want to talk a little bit about another aspect of media coverage of this issue, which is something that you have often whenever there is a controversy like this. Often you find a good portion of media analysis and commentary in the mainstream devoted not as much to the morality of the issue, the rights and wrongs, the ethics, but to strategy. And you see a lot of, the CNNs and other mainstream media organizations talking about, can Don Imus hang on? Is he going to be able to do damage control? What are his media strategies and PR strategies like? And it's right. Infuriating, at least to me, to read that.
Well, it's absolutely infuriating. And I think one important aspect of media that this whole Imus scandal and brouhaha sheds light, much needed light on, is the way that these media people and these outlets collude with each other. You know, this notion, it's been shocking to me, the sort of can Don hang on, what's he going to do, well, didn't he apologize? When you look at the roster of major journalists and media professionals who not only have been on Don Imus's show, but are regular guests on Don Imus's show, and who have defended him and sort of, oh, well, he apologized, so it's okay, let's move on, who are all, I might add, white males, you know, it should make us look critically at them.
That was journalist and activist Jill Nelson speaking with Uprising Radio host Sonali Kolhatkar. Texas executed James Lee Clark last night, despite claims his life should be spared because he was mentally retarded. The U.S. Supreme Court banned such executions in 2002, but Texas law provides no clear guidelines on how to enact the high court's ruling at the state level. From Houston, FSRN's Renee Feltz has more.
James Clark managed to say howdy to witnesses watching his execution before lethal drugs took effect and ended his life. Clark was sentenced to die for the robbery, rape, and murder of 17-year-old Sherry Catherine Cruz in 1993. Just 3 years ago, a federal court halted his execution in order to resolve questions about his mental retardation. Death Penalty Information Center Director Richard Dieter.
Some IQ tests on Mr. Clark indicated an IQ of 68, which is well below the standard for mental retardation. Other IQ tests were an IQ of 74.
That placed Clark's mental capacities at the very bottom of the U.S. average, the lowest 8%. Dieter says the dispute in Clark's case centered on whether the state would use tests conducted by two psychologists who examined Clark according to the American Association on Mental Retardation testing requirements, or a test presented by the prosecutor from a psychologist who examined Clark for 2 hours, did no comprehensive testing, and claimed he deliberately performed poorly on IQ tests. A Texas judge accepted the latter and approved Clark's execution. Clark's case was re-examined following a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 2002 called Atkins v. Virginia that bars execution of the mentally retarded. After the Atkins ruling, many states enacted guidelines for how courts determine mental retardation. Texas Senator Rodney Ellis introduced guidelines modeled on those passed in Florida. His proposal failed, and his spokesperson Jeremy Warren explains,
"We've been pushing ever since to try to get that decision essentially codified in Texas law. And the response has been, well, we just don't execute people who are retarded. And the numbers say otherwise. The advocates and experts say otherwise. And for whatever reason, Texas continues to not adhere to the Supreme Court's edict."
Texas has moved several mentally retarded prisoners off of death row on a case-by-case basis. But Texas lawmakers remain deadlocked over how to define mental retardation, when to conduct IQ tests, and whether to consider adaptive behavior.
District attorneys will sometimes use that adaptive behavior
to say, well, this person, even though he may have an IQ of 60 or 65 or 55, the person isn't really mentally retarded because of adaptive behavior. But everybody adapts to a certain extent. They still have the low IQ, and I think the IQ ought to be the determining factor. I wish that would get clarified.
Death penalty abolitionist Dave Atwood has lobbied lawmakers to determine mental retardation before a trial starts, but he says prosecutors want IQ tests introduced later in the proceedings.
After the jury has heard about the case, many times they will vote for that person being not mentally retarded, even though the person may be. So that's been the big holdup in Texas.
This deadlock on Atkins legislation isn't uncommon. The original Atkins case is still undecided, but its impact is greater in Texas, which carried out 12 of 13 executions in the United States this year. Atwood notes Wednesday's execution of a possibly mentally retarded man marked a milestone for Governor Rick Perry.
He today meets the record that George Bush set of 152 executions. And it looks now that Perry, while he's in office, is going to exceed what Bush did.
In Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
A runoff in East Timor's presidential election looks to be contested by the current prime minister and a candidate of the ruling party. But five other candidates are alleging discrepancies in the voting and are threatening to take the issue to the high court. Many in the country still hope that the final round of voting will resolve the political tension and instability in the young country, which experienced violent clashes last summer between rival military factions that left 30 people dead. From Dili, Indonesia, Radio 68H's Sutami and Besti Shirigar report on the political battle that's heating up.
Fretilin has run an election campaign largely based on its glorious past. Fretilin was the underground party that fought a bloody battle for independence from Indonesia. Many Timorese still have a very strong emotional attachment to the party. Their candidate, Francisco Guterres, better known as Luolo, has however been reluctant to outline clear policies.
After the election, we will see what the situation is like, especially when it's come to our safety. After that, we will go ahead with our plans.
But analysts suggest Luolo will find it difficult to beat Horta in a second round of voting. Local political analyst Francisco da Costa Guterres predicts that six other presidential candidates will now likely rally support for José Ramos Horta. Fretilin is seen by these small opposition parties as having too much power in the parliament. In the notoriously violent Dili suburb of Comoro, children play on streets where rival gangs clash at night. The gangs are part of martial arts schools and are directly linked to the political parties. The Kung Fu Master Gang claims to have 15,000 members nationwide and supports José Ramos Horta. Alarico Pereira is one of their leaders.
We're hoping that he will be able to improve the situation if he becomes president. Hopefully things will get better.
There is 50% unemployment in Timor-Leste, and most of the gang members are jobless men in their early 20s. Sacred Heart is another one of these gangs. Its 10,000 members are strongly backing Fretilin. When I met their leader, Joao Martinez, he is heavily guarded by his men. He believes Fretilin needs more time in power.
They have already made plans for the next 5 years. I think if Fretilin wins, there will be a lot of progress and development in this country. It's like building a house. We already have a foundation. If Horta wins, it will be like starting from scratch.
But Martinez, who has been with Sacred Heart for 20 years, knows that there is a possibility that his party will lose. And he is promising to accept the election results, whatever they are. The head of the United Nations mission here, Atul Kare, hopes all rival groups will take this attitude.
Accepting results includes accepting defeat and using the defeat as an opportunity to form a strong opposition. This will be especially important for the parliamentary elections.
Parliamentary elections are scheduled for later this year. This report was produced by Sutami of Radio 68H Dili for Free Speech Radio News. I'm Besti Siregar.
The Italian medical NGO, known as Emergency, has pulled its staff out of Afghanistan. The group has worked in the country since 1999, providing civilian medical assistance. But now that one of the NGO's staff members has been arrested, the group has fled the country. FSRN's Dileta Varlesi has the story.
Emergency has been accused by Hamullah Saleh, chief of Afghan security services, of supporting the Taliban. Fearing for the safety of its staff, the NGO evacuated its 40 foreign workers to Dubai yesterday. Emergency runs 3 hospitals and 28 clinics in Afghanistan. Emergency Vice President Carlo Garbagnati said local staff are continuing to operate the health facilities.
Our hospitals are still operating in the country with the local personnel that we have trained this year. As of yet, we have no idea how the situation will evolve. When we received the slander yesterday, we expected the Italian government to take up our defense, but this did not happen. Therefore, we considered the situation too dangerous for our staff there. I want to stress that we were asked by the Italian government to negotiate for the Italian journalist's release, and we accepted only to save a human life.
Emergency has provided medical services in Afghanistan for 8 years. The present difficulties begin when one of their staff, Ramatullah Hanefi, at the request of Prodi government, helped negotiate the release of Italian journalist Daniele Mastrogiacomo. Mastrogiacomo was released last week in exchange for 5 Taliban prisoners held by the Afghan government, but his interpreter, Ajmal Naqshbandi, remained as hostage. 2 days ago, Naqshbandi was beheaded by his captors. Almost immediately, Hanefi was seized by Afghan security officers who claimed that he is collaborating with the Taliban. Patrizia Santinelli is Italy's Vice Minister for Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation.
We must give all our solidarity to the NGO Emergency, and we have to repeat together that the NGO is not a supporter of the Taliban. The Secret Services accusation should be taken back. As the Italian government, we should also keep struggling for Hanefi's release and cancel all the accusations against him.
The deal reached with the Taliban for Mastrogiacomo's release was criticized by many Afghans for showing more concern for foreigners than locals. Whether Mastrogiacomo was saved by a prisoner exchange, the journalist, driver and translator were both killed. At the same time, the Italian government's practice of negotiating for the release of Italian citizens is in direct contradiction to US policy on the same issue. This led to diplomatic spats in the past, for example, when Giuliana Sgrena was captured in Iraq in 2005. The Karzai government is thus under conflicting pressure from 2 of the countries providing troops for the international force. Giovanni Russo Spena is a Communist Party senator and one of the most critical of how Prodi's government has managed the affair so far.
I believe the U.S. government is actively intervening through Karzai to create in Afghanistan a situation similar to that in Iraq, that is, justifying preventative global war. The U.S. provokes this situation by obstructing efforts based on solidarity and sharing. Efforts that create networks of cooperation, which a few NGOs still in Afghanistan do.
Italy's ruling left coalition is split on policy in Afghanistan. The extension of funding for Italy's military mission came only at the second attempt. The Italian parliament today devoted a full day to discuss negotiation processes in Afghanistan since 2000. Ultimately, the continued war in Afghanistan and conflicting policy amongst NATO partners will harm Afghan people the most. The increased risk to humanitarian workers, both local and foreign, means they now face the loss of one of the most established medical services in the country. For First Betrayed News, I'm Diletta Varlese in Brescia, Italy.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Abogado.